Hi everybody and welcome and thanks very much for coming at the new time as well. I'm really pleased that I invited Marie Leconte, a few months ago now to come and talk about political gossip because since the invitation was issued, political gossip, the culture of Westminster has become the driving force of the news agenda and of the political agenda in Britain today. Marie, for those of you who don't know, has been the best, funniest commentator on UK politics for the last X number of years. She's a freelance journalist who's written for The Guardian, The New Statesman, Prospect, Chatham House, appeared on TV and radio. She's brilliantly funny on Twitter as the young vulgarian. And she has this brilliant tone of being both an insider and an outsider because she's French, because she's a freelancer, because her natural tendency is to look at things with a slightly wry eye, but is also brilliantly well-connected and has the kind of persona that people just seem to tell all their secrets to. She has a new book out that I highly recommend called Haven't You Heard? And it basically touches on this topic. It's all about Westminster politics. And if you want to know how British government worked for the last, since World War II and beyond, before, have a look at it. It's a brilliant read, very easy to read. And I want to start on that actually, because you, as I galloped through the book in one sitting, and I used to work in the British newspapers, and it reflected a lot of what I already thought I knew about UK politics. But do you think that fundamentally it's still the same with this new government, with the new intake, with this ban on, a different attitude to the media?
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think, and there's a few different things there, but I think the first one is that it's always really funny to see a new government come in, but especially, and I think that's quite specific, really, to British politics, of like, there's a new government coming in, there's a new chief of staff to the prime minister, usually a man, so obviously it's currently Dominic Cummings, we had Nick Timothy before that, there was Alistair Campbell way back, Peter Mandelson to an extent, etc. So there's this, like, man who arrives, and he's very clever and very different and a bit weird. and he's going to do things differently. And every single time. And it's like, people have been doing X and Y and Z. We'll stop all that. And it's a bit, I always find it funny because there's a reason why whenever a new person comes in, they have to do it again. Because actually that never works. Things always revert back to the way they were. Special advisors will always end up talking to journalists. MPs will always end up talking to journalists. Ministers will always end up doing stuff behind number 10's back, etc. Like, there is no, again, there's a reason why things are the way they are. But I do think that's kind of a more general point about Westminster as well, in that it works, like, it's very set in its own ways, I think, as a political system. And yeah, and as you've pointed out, things, the way things work now, broadly, obviously not talking about social media, the internet and whatever, because that was added on, but the fundamentals are the same as they were sort of, decades ago.
And if we start with that, and this is Westminster political culture, which is, again, quite a unique British institution, and it's both rooted in the building, the kind of Houses of Parliament and the streets around it, but also a mindset and a social network of people who are very often were at university together and have worked together and come together to form this club. And this club constitutes MPs, special advisors, journalists, and to some extent, civil servants. And in your book, you describe, it feels almost very claustrophobic. It's, it's people always hanging out with the same people within the same four walls. Firstly, do you think that's true? And what effect do you think that has on both political culture and political reporting?
Weirdly, so I agree, but I'm not sure I would say it feels claustrophobic most of the time. Mm-hmm. I think I would sort of see it the other way, and I think it sort of feels safe in a mm-hmm. weird way. And that's something that annoyingly I got thinking about mostly by doing events about the book. Yeah. Therefore, that's not a bit that's in the book, because I'd not had that thought yet when I was writing it. But I think what we forget, and Michelle, that's quite a basic point, but that gets forgotten a lot about Westminster, is that a lot of people there are not from London. So a lot of people, so MPs, quite a lot of them, when they get elected, either they've never lived in London or maybe they studied here, but now they're in their 40s and, and they sort of come down and they've got these really weird hours, and obviously they've got these important jobs in the public eye. And how on earth would you make friends? How would you go about making friends outside of Westminster if you were, let's say, 42 years old down in London? So, like 3 days a week. So I think you've got those, you've got people who work in Parliament, so mostly for MPs, tend to move to London straight after university. So again, you know, don't really know London, don't really necessarily have friends there, don't really know the place, etc. And are usually quite nerdy, because actually if you go decide to work in politics at 20 or 21, 22, you know, you're probably, yeah, on the wonkier end of the scale, I think, to call it, you know, a nice way. But yes, we've got that, and journalists similar as well. So I do think it's kind of a group of people who move into London. They don't necessarily know the place, and obviously it's, you know, it's a big place that's quite intimidating. They've got a set of interests that is quite niche. You know, most people do not massively care about politics. And they sort of find themselves suddenly, you know, in this bubble that's maybe, you know, what, not even a square mile, like, you know, Westminster itself is tiny. And I think you do kind of end up having a sort of village mentality where you spend all of your time there, all of your friends are there, you know, and I've sort of had it as well. You know, you end up having puzzling conversations, especially by London standards, of being like, you want us to go to that pub? It's a 12-minute walk. Jesus Christ, you know, what are you thinking? So it is literally like, it becomes entirely like village life. And there's a bit in the book actually about, so I interviewed people who work for the House of Commons Library. And I asked them, you know, I asked everyone, I was like, you know, what's your social life like in Westminster? Do you ever drink in Parliament? Because obviously Parliament has several bars. And they're like, oh, no, so we're on Tothill Street. So, you know, we never drink in Parliament. So to be clear, Tothill Street is at most an 8-minute walk from Parliament. But for them, it was like, oh, no, well, obviously we're on the other side of Westminster. So, you know, why would you go to Parliament? So I think that, you know, it does create, and again, I think it feels claustrophobic when things are going badly. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, yeah, like village life, I suppose, where it's kind of like quite cozy and safe and nice. But then obviously when things go wrong, it does start to feel a bit close.
What does what starts happening when things are going badly?
Ooh, people drink too much, probably. But I think I was actually talking about it with a friend yesterday, literally, about how, because I think,
and by going badly, you mean like a government that's about collapsing or a national crisis? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that the last few years of Brexit chaos are probably like quite a handy example. But I think, yeah, one of the things we've not really mentioned is the slightly weird hours as well. Of like most votes in Parliament can happen at sort of, you know, 10 p.m. on weeknights. And that means obviously MPs have to stay in the parliamentary estate. They can't really make plans or nothing. And so you will end up, you know, those people will end up having their dinners in Parliament, will probably end up having drinks, like not necessarily in a toxic way, but just because, you know, if you have to end up staying in your workplace until 11 p.m., you'd be forgiven for having a pint at some point, because you're not really doing anything either. Like, you know, you're just kind of waiting for the votes. And obviously where MPs are, journalists follow. So, by the way, please shout at me if I speak too quickly. I'm normally a very fast speaker, so this is quite, it's fine, yeah. No, it's my problem. But anyway, so you do end up, I think, having, so that's why I think when things go badly, for example, you know, as in, you know, when there's, yeah, like general parliamentary chaos, you will probably end up seeing things getting quite toxic quite quickly, because it becomes really easy for people to be like, you know, I can't be bothered with this. I'll just, you know, I'll just have one drink too many, or I'll just, you know, kind of, and again, you know, and then get into gossip as well of like, you know, I shouldn't be sharing that stuff, but I don't care. I don't give a shit about my government anymore. I'm just going to, you know, go talk to the journalists. So again, I think the line is quite thin between, yeah, you know, things going well and then people kind of misbehaving and going.
Go ahead.
I don't know about what the typical workplace culture is here. Why would anyone do that? Like, the last thing you want to do is to have a meltdown before in front of the people you work with. Is that, how do you compare that to, you know, normal workplace culture?
Ooh, so I've never worked in a normal workplace. So I don't know. Because even, you know, newspaper newsrooms, I find, are not really what you would call a normal workplace. But I think that's sort of the problem, actually, of obviously, like, journalists have,
I mean,
a culture
this
of
is
drinking,
worth highlighting,
and politics has as well. And
there are bars inside Parliament serving alcohol. Yeah. So I think, just starting from that level,
which
that's
is
something.
Mad, by the way, yeah. Yeah. It is one of the things, as a foreigner, where I'm like, hang on. So, yeah. Oh, I can definitely get onto that. So the way political journalism works is that, so you've got something called the lobby, which is, so the word comes from, a lobby in the House of Commons where only MPs and journalists with a lobby access have access to, so they can talk to MPs there. And the rule, that the lobby rule, is that everything said in that lobby is off the record by definition. So that's the lobby. What it means effectively is that you've got, so each publication gets given a number of lobby passes, and then they kind of hand them out to, you know, between normally that one and like seven journalists. And these are the ones who have access to the House of Commons. They normally have access to a briefing from someone in number 10 twice a day. But more importantly, you know, they're kind of, if you're not lobby, it makes it a lot harder for you to be a political journalist. And that can be like people like me. So I'm freelance. And again, so annoyingly, the passes are tied to publications, not people. So I can't get one. Obviously, yeah, foreign journalists, I think, because there's the Foreign Press Association that tries quite often to be like, hi, like, we exist, we are trying to cover British politics, you know, please give us, you know, people to talk to, please give us access to briefings. But that is really hard, because I think there's still, I don't know, there's a bit of a cartel mentality, I suppose, of like, you know, you have to be one of the proper, like, accredited lobby journalists to have access to everything, and if not, then screw you, which is immensely frustrating. Now that's, you know, obviously something I feel, because, you can't really have access to Parliament otherwise.
Barbara, on that note, can I just ask a bit more about the recent events with the lobby walking out in protest at the meeting, and what your take on it as someone who's not part of that group anyway? And I mean, everyone knows this story of the lobby.
My first take is I think that there's nothing in this world journalists like talking about more than themselves. So I think that that was quite a big part of it. But no, I don't really know. Again, I think that comes back to the kind of, you know, ooh, like Dominic Cummings, you know, like I'm weird and I'm going to, you know, do whatever I want. So I'm not sure how important it is. I think it was kind of muscle flexing on his part, as opposed to, you know, it's not something that I think was a genuine threat to democracy. It was more a case of him being like, I don't like you and I'm going to annoy you on purpose, and that's that, and there's nothing you can do about it. But then, whereas, you know, whether that's a good idea, you know, to do that, I think is quite a different question. And again, I'm not sure if we'll get onto that or not, but I do think that quite an important thing in Westminster is the personal relationships, and actually whether, you know, people like you or not. And the kind of opposite example, I suppose, which is in the book, but so it was Tessa Jowell, who was a Labour minister some years ago. And so I interviewed several, obviously, journalists for the book who've been political journalists for a long time. And two of them, unprompted, mentioned the case of Tessa. So it's a long, quite boring story, but her husband had been involved in some really, really dodgy stuff involving Silvio Berlusconi. And, you know, and apparently she didn't know about it. I think it was more the money side. Several journalists said, actually, you know what? She probably should have resigned over it, and actually we probably should have made her resign as the press. But the fact is, we all really liked her, and, you know, and we did report the story out, you know, don't get me wrong, like, you know, we did publish the stories, but actually in terms of the tone, in terms of the prominence of the story, like, we never called, you know, on number 10 to sack her and stuff like that, because she was always nice to us, because we liked her, because we had a good working relationship with her. And I think that actually happens a lot in political journalism. Mm-hmm. And again, I think in a way that's maybe conscious and unconscious as well. But I think, yeah, there's the occasional person of being like, okay, well, I don't know, let's say that you know, that MP is a very, very good source. If they do one minor silly thing, maybe I wouldn't, like, you know, maybe I shouldn't report on it, because, you know, because actually they're giving me so much more stuff. But also I think it is quite unconscious of, if people like you, they're more likely to see you in a good light. And I think that matters more in political journalism, because political journalism is so much about the personal aspect of stuff. Like, it's not just reporting on documents or what happens with the Commons. It's a lot about, you know, kind of secondhand reports and the softer side. So I think that people like Dominic Cummings may find that if you get all the journalists who hate you, like, maybe you'll feel good about it at first, but actually what you've done is that there's tons of people who really want to, like, stick, you know, to kind of stick into you at some point, because journalists are quite petty.
I mean, you, at the moment, and I'll come to you, do you think that the government ministers would rather have more contact with journalists? Are they happy with this current sense sense of kind of belligerence and hostility that they can hide behind, or would they rather have a more chatty working relationship, do you think?
I don't know. So I did have one really funny encounter about 3 weeks ago, I think, where I was at some drinks reception in Westminster, and there was, because obviously we've had tons of new MPs joining us recently, I was on my way out, and this MP stopped me. Like, we follow each other on Twitter, but we'd never met. And he was like, "Hey," so I was like, "Hey, nice to meet you." And I said, I was like, "Listen, I'm really sorry, I've really got to run away, but let's get a drink soon, let's get a coffee, like, get properly introduced." And then he was like, "Oh, no, I'm new. The whip said I can't talk to journalists." But like, in exactly the same tone as a child going, "My mum says I can't." And it really struck me as like, you just seem very scared of journalists because you're very new, and it is very convenient for you to have an excuse to be like, no, I wish I could, but no. So I think there's a bit of that, of you know, kind of being able to say, actually, yeah, no, exactly, to hide behind it. But equally, I don't, because normally, and that's kind of, in a weird way, I think the central message of the book, that actually, you know, gossip is something, you know, gossip and informal networks and formal information, I suppose, and informal ways of sharing information kind of like democratize how information is shared in Parliament, if that makes sense. So actually, you know, if you look at, you know, because I think quite a lot of people would argue and say, you know, actually, you know, there shouldn't be that many of the record briefings, or MPs shouldn't talk to journalists and get published, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, the logical conclusion to that would be that only official channels and official sources could ever talk to journalists. You would only ever really get the position of number 10. Like, that would give so much more power to number 10. Because actually, you know, the formal channels are always going to be tied to the executive. And so actually having, I think, being able to have all those different places, feeling, you know, the entitlement, and, you know, to say, actually, I'm going to talk, you know, I'm going to tell journalists my version of this, probably gives us a much better picture of what actually goes on, as opposed to if it were only from, like, descended from the heavens.
Thank you. And it kind of goes to the thing of, like, what's political journalism for? And you kind of said, well, most people don't care about political reporting. Now, isn't that the fundamental problem at the moment, that political journalism is not being reported in a way that people should care? Because it governs their lives, and yet there's a constant criticism about political journalism, especially the lobby journalism, that it is reporting on this Westminster world that is closed and different for many people.
So I think there's two angles to that. The first one is that, because I interviewed Tim Shipman for the book, and he made the point of saying, well, actually, you know, my work gets attacked quite often for basically being posh gossip. Because a lot of it is about the personal stuff. It's about, you know, Michael Gove, you know, back in the day, like, Michael Gove had a fight with David Cameron, or, you know, like, those two MPs had a blazing row, they didn't get along, or this happened, or blah, blah, blah. But his argument was saying, actually, you know, in British politics, you can't really understand anything that's going on if you don't take the personal into account, because, you know, and even more so, I think, in Britain than in other countries, it is massively about the personalities, about the personal relationships. And as you've mentioned, obviously a lot of those people knew each other before joining Parliament. And actually that's always going to colour the way they work together. So you do, I think, you know, it is the duty, like, there is a public interest angle, I think, to publishing stuff that at first may just look like quite fun, sort of like gossip. But then the other thing as well, and I think, you know, politics is one topic of it. I don't think it's the only one, but there's kind of like the great hypocrisy of the readers who are like, oh, but, you know, why do you keep publishing stuff that's like sensationalized and, like, you know, and gossipy and frivolous? So they kind of say that on the one hand. And then on the other, you know, over the past like decade or so, we've been able to track what readers read. And that is all they read. Like, they never read the dry, serious, important, worthy stuff that apparently, you know, they want newspapers to write more about. And, you know, and I think, again, that applies to politics, but that applies to other bits of coverage of actually, you know, this is what, you know, people do want the colour. And if you look at, you know, what, I can't remember what it was. Oh, yeah, no, because it was, what, I can't remember what year it was. I want to say 2014, after, so party conferences that happen every September and October in Britain. And I think, obviously, the last one before the 2015 election, and Ed Miliband had announced, like, lots of, like, big policies, you know, obviously, like, trying to kickstart the election campaign early, I suppose. And, you know, and there'd been lots in the news about Labour. And, yeah, and this newspaper commissioned a study of their readers, saying, OK, well, you know, what do you know about Ed Miliband? What do you, you know, what do you know about him? What do you remember about him? And the majority of people only remember the fact that he'd stabbed his brother in the back. Mm. So had won it over his brother in the leadership contest of 2010. So in 4 years, that's the only thing they'd remembered about Ed. And presumably
I
quite liked him. But
then
yeah.
He couldn't eat a bacon sandwich.
And then it became the bacon sandwich. So actually, you know, Ed Miliband, his two things are he stabbed his brother in the back by running against him in the leadership contest in 2010. And in 2015, he ate a bacon sandwich weirdly. So it is the thing. And you could argue, I think, that it is maybe a vicious circle of, you know, kind of journalists printing more of the stuff and then readers reading it and then, you know. But equally, I think, and again, and that's probably slightly off topic, but I think in Britain especially, at least compared to France, newspapers are at heart commercial, you know, they're companies, they're trying to make, they're businesses, they're trying to make money. And so you do, you know, it's all well and good to do the approach of, you know, we'll just publish very worthy things that deserve to be published. But actually, if no one's reading them, you're not going to be able to keep doing that for that long. Mm-hmm.
Daniela?
Yeah. Is there any difference between gossips and information women MPs tell you and men tell you MPs?
That's a really good question. Weirdly, I would say men are actually the worst gossips in Parliament. I think they're the ones more like, they're the ones more likely to share the, like, you know, the shagging stories, the, like, oh, my God, you know, the stuff where it's like, oh, you know, like, Jesus Christ, why are you sharing that with me? But
shagging is having sex. But
I think more important, like, more interestingly, if you read the book, there are considerably more men than women quoted, which I'm really not happy with. But basically, so when I set out to write the book and to interview tons of people, and especially MPs, I really tried to go 50-50 in terms of interviewees, because obviously I wanted to get the views of everyone. But then what I found, which really surprised me, was that so women were, on the one hand, overwhelmingly more likely to say, actually, you know, fine, I'll talk to you for the book, but I don't want my name anywhere near it. It just has to be a Labour MP or a Conservative MP. Or say, actually, no, I'm sorry, I want nothing to do with a book about gossip. Whereas the men just like, yeah, fine, yeah, put my name on it, fine. And it's like, oh, cool. But I think that's because gossip is such a gendered term. So, you know, and obviously, you know, it's quite, you know, gossip normally outside of politics, it is something, you know, it's something the women do, you know, when they go to the bathroom together and like they, and it was, you know, and it is, you know, it's seen as quite a negative thing. But then, I think there's also the kind of weird fundamental hypocrisy at the heart of politics, which is that absolutely everyone gossips and you need to do it in order to do your job properly as well. So even if it's not something you enjoy doing for fun, I think it is something you do need to do. But equally, you know, if you're marked as a gossip or as someone who gossips, then that gives you a bad reputation. So it's sort of like everyone does it, but there's clearly some sort of line. And then the second you cross it, because I remember like interviewing one former special advisor who was a woman, surprisingly, and he said, oh yeah, no, at some point, you know, I nearly got a big promotion to get into number 10 as an advisor there. She was like, no, didn't get the job in the end, and I'm absolutely certain that's because people think I'm a gossip. So I think, you know, everyone gossips. I would say again, even like the men perhaps do it even more than the women, but the women tend to be the ones who suffer from it more.
Way.
Between journalists and politicians in Britain, there seems to be a very surprising revolving door. Like journalists become politicians and politicians become journalists, which is unthinkable. Like, can you imagine Stephen Newton at New York Post? Do you think that contributes to this sort of small club mentality that, you know, journalists like to be associated with powerful people, so they cover them and write these gossip stories that the rest of the country can't really relate to, and that also contributes to declining trust in both politics and journalism?
Get on to the big stuff.
Yeah. I broadly agree. So I would say that I think it does tend to be more one way than the other. So I think it does still, most of the time, it is people who are in journalism for a while and then move into politics. That is quite rare for people. I suppose some people who are, you know, former politicians, I guess, can move into journalism or back into journalism, but that's normally more like they may get like an opinion column in a paper or something, like they're not gonna become an editor or something, like most of the time. So I think it is one way. But that being said, I do absolutely agree. I think it reinforces the kind of bubble feeling. And again, you know, I don't think it's something that's inherently sort of like nefarious. So it's, you know, it's not people in dark rooms going, ha 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 ha. But it is, you know, and I think again, even coming back to the kind of village feeling as well, like I always kind of see my job as basically a local reporter, but for the Westminster Village, because actually, you know, and I feel like I'm honest with it. In that I know that what I write is mostly actually quite interesting, I think, to the bubble. So it's about the bubble for the bubble. But I do think that even people who work for newspapers who may, you know, who technically obviously have their readers in mind, but it is, I think it's quite easy to fall into the trap of doing stories, you know, that will make other journalists jealous or that will make MPs go, ooh, like what, you know. So I think, yeah, like it's more likely basically to get your surroundings, I suppose, to influence you. Whether that has an influence on the trust people have in journalism, I don't know, because I suspect that actually the vast majority of people have no idea that, you know, some relatively junior journalist jumped ship and went to become a press advisor for Labour, for example, or something. So I think that
people think of George Osborne. He's a fairly unique case.
I had fully forgotten about that. Yeah, that was insane. Yeah. No, that was really weird. I genuinely forgot that's something I think that was just so absurd that, you know, I'm just like, I just filed it in a weird cabinet in my head. So
this is George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, becoming editor of the Evening Standard, which is now kind of Free Sheet daily newspaper.
Apart from that one huge example I couldn't think about, it never happened. I mean, I think that just made everyone look bad, to be honest. There's not much more I can say about it, really.
There's a lot of people, Michael Gove was a journalist, Boris Johnson was a journalist, Yvette Cooper from Labour was a journalist. Mm. A lot of journalists going into politics, which goes to your point. Not many going the other way, with the exception of George Osborne.
People are going to criticise Boris Johnson for being a dishonest politician.
Yeah, they should have looked at his journalism history. Yeah, they'd have had a clue. I don't think they cared, either way. At the back, Yaka.
Feeling among the journalists reporting about other journalists in Westminster, because does that happen much? And exposing other people's failures and so on, or is there kind of, I won't stab you,
that? That's an interesting question. So do journalists hold each other to account?
No.
why not? Because
exactly that. I think there's a bit of a, you know, wolves don't bite wolves kind of mentality to it, of, you know, and especially I think within the lobby of, like, you know, you're part of this sort of like pack, and you don't, well, then I don't know. And I think it's not something I've written about before, it's something I've tweeted about, because I do feel quite strongly about it, but I think it's something that was bad already but has become worse for social media, in that, so as I see it, we're kind of stuck in this vicious circle where let's say a political journalist screws up, like does something very straightforwardly they should not have done, or, you know, that was wrong or whatever. And then all the other journalists say nothing about it to protect them. But then what happens is that all of those journalists collectively get massively criticized and receive sort of like tons of abuse on social media for being like, why would you not denounce that? Why would you not speak up about that? But then the more people do that, the more defensive of each other the journalists feel, and the more likely they are to stick together. The more likely they are to stick together, the more likely they are to look bad and basically attract tons of abuse. And yeah, and I think we've been stuck in this cycle for a few years now, and I have no idea how we get out of it. And it worries me.
It's odd because the press is quite partisan.
Yeah.
Really, many of the papers
So I agree that most papers are partisan, but most journalists aren't. And, you know, it's something I found really weird moving here, and still to an extent, but, you know, there's quite a lot of people who are like, oh yes, obviously I worked at the Daily Mail for 7 years, then I moved to the Guardian for 10 years, then I went to the Express or something, and it's like, but these are such different papers. that's something I find quite baffling. But it does mean that I think, again, it is slightly different, and that is the publications who have the slump, and actually quite a lot. I would say the vast majority of political journalists would be perfectly happy working for like a Labour supporting paper, a Tory supporting paper, So they're probably not going to attack, you know, if they're working, let's say, for the Mirror, they may not attack someone who works for the Mail over like a Tory thing they've done, because actually that person, you know, may either join the Mail at some point, or that guy from the Mail may join the Mirror at some point. So I think that there's quite a small pool effectively. And if you look at it as well, I think in terms of, so that's just quite niche now, but in terms of like who gets hired within the lobby as well, it is a bit of a catch-22 thing in that I feel like, you know, you already need to be in the lobby to get a job in the lobby. So I think, you know, that it is very much like a small pool of people kind of moving around endlessly.
John, did you have a question?
Andrew Marr, in the book My Trick, called journalism, that's why I trust. I think you're wrong about the program. It won't be about the default position. It's not what John Cummings is doing. He talks about serious control of the media by Cummings. That is what he wants to do. As long as he's whispered in Boris's ear, there will be serious control of the media. You can see it day after day after day. And lastly, it's a pretty good Mail story. That's essentially political gossip, and there's much more to come.
Cool. So the first point, I actually agree with you. So like what I should have been clearer. What I meant is that there have been a lot of sort of, you know, very clever and odd powerful men whispering into the ear of the Prime Minister. They've all fallen in disgrace at some point. You know, so if you look at, again, you know, everyone from, yeah, Damian McBride, Alistair Campbell, Nick Timothy, Steve Hilton, that none of them, you know, not a single of their careers, you know, ended in a great success. So, you know, they just had a nice time in number 10. So I suspect that, you know, Dominic Cummings may not be gone now or in 6 months, but I really don't see him still working in number 10 by the end of this term. But, you know, but maybe not. Who knows? Sorry?
You might be there for him.
But, and the Preeti Patel story, because you've written some very good profiles.
Oh, thank you. But, you know, I had a profile of Preeti Patel published yesterday. And I don't know, so I would... And again, that's kind of something I struggled with a bit in the book, of trying to define what gossip is. Because actually, you know, allegations of bullying... I suppose, yeah, on the one hand, I suppose you could argue that, you know, allegations of bullying are not gossip because it's very serious. It's very, very serious allegations that could result in her losing her job, and obviously she's, gonna, what's his name, Philip Putnam?
Rutnam.
I can never remember his name. Yeah. I don't know why. I did a radio show on Sunday and had to write his name on my hand to make sure that I could. Wouldn't it be like names that occasionally just don't stay in your brain? You know, so yeah, so I think on the one hand you could say, you know, it's very serious allegations, therefore it doesn't count as gossip. But I suppose that on the other, you know, most of what we know is from, you know, second, third hand anonymous sources. And so, I'm not entirely sure. Like, I would, again, I think it's one of those stories that's kind of in a large grey area of, you know, is it gossip or is it just news? I would personally argue, I think it is just news, but also, also I'm sure you could, you know, you can make a reasonable argument for it being gossip.
Go ahead.
I really enjoy your talk. I used to be... And I also felt like a village, small community newspaper. You know, what I write is really interesting to the villagers, but not what outsiders. I want to ask you a question about political spin. I see a lot of articles written by journalists that seems to be a lot of political spin coming from the Cummings. And it's very hard for political journalists not to write, although knowing that this is just a spin, that, you know, you end up being amplifying the government, role of government PR. But you can't just ignore it. But you know that things that you're doing is not really helping political reporting. So what do you think of this, you know, how political journalists should cover these leaks or spin that is coming from the heart of the tent?
Well, I think...
It's hard not to cover it.
It is, and I think basically the problem as well is that, again, with Westminster reporting, you know, that there's very little that's just formal and based on data, based on documents. You know, you can do the occasional sort of like freedom of information request, or you can, you know, there may be a story coming from a select committee hearing or from what happens in the chamber of the House of Commons or the House of Lords, but actually all of that tends to be nearly a minority compared to, you know, most of what really happens in politics, but that annoyingly happens behind closed doors. And so you do need to rely on someone telling you about it. And, you know, and the obvious problem with that is that, you know, you're all journalists, that you'll know that it is quite rare, you know, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It clearly does sometimes, but the overwhelming majority of the time, you know, someone is not going to give you a story out of the goodness of their own heart. Like, you know, there's normally an agenda, or there's normally, you know, and it may be that agenda is that, you know, it's just, I've witnessed something that, you know, that is wrong, and I just felt I needed to speak up. Obviously, that's the best one. You know, that's a great straightforward source that you want, you know, the one being like trying to right a wrong. But that, you know, it most of the time is that actually, you know, I'm going to tell you what happened there because it would really help me or my party or my faction if that person were to go down. You know, so it's always, they're always doing it for a reason. And I think that there's the issue, and probably more so weirdly in political journalism of, yeah, how, you know, and I suppose it's probably needs to be a chart of like how much you're being basically used as a puppet, you know, in a war between two factions, for example, versus how good the story is. Like, that's personally how I'd see it. And if the story is better, then, you know, you're obviously being used and you should probably publish it. And if not, you shouldn't. But then, yeah, I mean, that being said, like, my honest answer to that is that I think it's a really tricky balance to manage, which is why I moved from news to features 2.5 years ago. Because genuinely, I found it really hard. And I can think of a few stories I did back when I was doing news. That, you know, and that were very decent. You know, they were not world-changing, but they were decent stories, and they were not necessarily like a smear or anything. But I did feel really dirty about them afterwards because they'd clearly been given to me by someone being like, well, fuck that guy. And there you go, you know, enjoy. And then I published it. And then, you know, and that person was shit. And I was like, oh, you know, but I just feel like a pawn in a game between, you know, different people in Westminster. And I'm not, you know, without having like grand ideas about, you know, what journalists should be. That's definitely not what I want to be. And, you know, but again, I think, you know, clearly a lot of journalists are better with it. And I think, again, it's about your kind of personal compass and your personal sense of, you know, whether that story helps someone more than it is in the public interest or vice versa. But, yeah, no, again, I escaped from it professionally entirely. So, yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, that was my question, but following on to that, have there been times that somebody has told you something and even if maybe it was an interesting story or something you know, people would have been interested in, but you were just like, no, I don't want to be used like this, I don't want to.
So have you ever said no to a story because you felt like you were being used?
Oh, probably. I don't know, I'm trying to think. But then it's a weird thing as well, I would say, of like a lot of the time, I would say, it's not quite someone coming up to you and, you know, and being like, hey, you know, got a scoop for you. It is because, you know, because again, coming back to the kind of like village life and the close personal and working relationships and et cetera, and the drinking culture, all that. So actually, you know, I feel like a lot of stories do tend to be, you know, just like you're in the pub with someone, they're like, oh, by the way, you know, did you hear this? Or like, do you want to do something with this? So in that respect, I'm pretty sure there's been stuff where I've gone, you know, I'm all right, but thanks. But I can't really think of any major examples. Although, that being said, as a sort of relevant side note, I do think that the other side, because we've not really talked about the close relationships between journalists and politicians, but I do think that's kind of something that plays into all that as well. But I think that there's the slightly weird thing as well of obviously as a journalist, you need to establish a good, I can't remember, like someone put it in a really fun way in my book, like one of the journalists I interviewed, basically his point was the trick with MPs, like the weird thing with MPs and with politicians fundamentally is that, you know, at heart they know that you're a journalist, they're a politician, you're talking to them as a journalist because they're a politician. But actually, you kind of need to make them feel like, of course, you know, you still be their mate if they lost their seat. Like, you know, you're just hanging out with them because you like hanging out with them. And which is true, because, you know, obviously, like, politicians have that weird mix of, like, a massive ego, but somehow at the same time, no ego at all. And it's kind of like a weird one to work around. So you do end up, I think, at that as a, yeah, again, slightly different point, but there is a slightly weird thing as well of in the process of establishing a relationship with a source. I think there's meant to be stuff that they'll tell you that's actually kind of in the public interest, but that they don't want you to print. And that's kind of in a nearly a test, I suppose, of, you know, can I trust you? And then if I can, then I'll you know, I'll trust you with bigger, proper stories further along the line. And I think that's another calculation political journalists have to make quite a lot, which I personally found super tricky as well. Like, you know, do you burn a source for a story that's maybe a 6 out of 10? Or do you not publish a story that's a 6 out of 10 because they've promised you that further down the line, if, you know, they could trust you with that one, they'd give you like a massive, massive scoop.
I mean, you had a line in your book that I mentioned this morning that's really striking, where you said the relationship between political journalists and politicians is one where you know you will betray them at some point, but until that moment, it has to be a relationship built on trust.
I nearly feel like a hypocrite, like, giving these talks, because I have stopped doing that job because I found it very stressful. Also, I really like it when people like me, and so it was just not for me. You know, I'd much rather do like big interviews about people and stuff. But anyway, on a more serious note, yes, and it's again a slightly weird, because one of my favorite anecdotes actually in the book was like, and I can't remember the names now because it was story that happened ages ago, but apparently some paper who did a big expose on a minister, and the minister had to resign. And then that night, the minister and the journalist were seen having drinks together in Parliament. And basically the idea was like, actually, you know what? The minister obviously was pissed off, but got that, you know, he'd done something wrong. Like, he was the one who'd fucked up. And actually, you know, it was the journalist's job to expose him. So no hard feelings. I'm like, that is so weird on a human level. How do you get to do, you know, how do you do that? Like, I'm not sure I could rise above it. So I think there is, again, for, you know, I was quite bad at it. I think people who do the jobs are better at it than me. But I think there is a level of knowing, you know, no matter how close we get or whatever, how long we've known each other for, at the end of the day, you know, if I have to betray you, I will.
Felix.
Cool.
I'm going to wave the slow page at you.
So, am I doing it again?
You were beginning to.
Sorry. I can remember that. Oh, how did I end up in Westminster? Kind of randomly. I know. So I got. I'm not going to tell the full story of how I got interested in politics, because it's quite a long one, and also a deeply unprofessional one.
Go on.
Okay.
I think I know the story.
Okay. It was a warm night in June 2010. May or June? When was the election?
May
2010. Yeah. So I started my degree in 2009 at the University of Westminster, and moved to London for it. I was 17. So yeah, I was 18, like the last night of my freshers year. And I went out to celebrate with some friends. And there was this guy I fancied who was in a band. Of course, he was in a band because I was 18. And he was playing a gig that night. So yeah, so I dragged my friends to this gig. And we all got, you know, so like merrily drunk. And then this beautiful like guitarist or whatever was like, hey, I'm having an after party in my house. Would you like to come? And I was like, oh my God, finally, you know, this guy I fancied for ages. So my friends didn't follow me. So I kind of followed that guy and his friends back to his house. And then the second we got to the house, he started chatting up another woman. And I was like, well, I don't know anyone here. Everyone here is quite a lot older than me. I do not know what to do with myself because I also don't know how to get home. But as it happened, it was the night of the general election of 2010. And so I was quite drunk and had no idea what to do. And the telly was on in the corner and I was like, oh, there's the election. And I didn't really know anything about politics. And so I just grabbed a bottle of wine and I sat by the telly. And started watching the election and just got weirdly into it, the way you get into stuff when you're really drunk and a teenager. And ended up staying at that guy's house, like watching the election until like 7 a.m. And kind of ended up becoming the political correspondent of the house party, where, you know, when there was big updates, they'd be like, by the way, hung parliament, you know, this is happening. And that was kind of it. Like, generally, that's kind of how...
Television does have a role still, and it's still attracting youth audiences. 10 years ago.
No, exactly. But also, I really feel like I need to come up with like maybe a slight lie. That's a like more professional.
No, that's
like,
brilliant.
It will come up in a serious setting once at some point. But anyway, yeah. So that is the genuine bona fide story of how I got into British politics. And the second question, which I think is super interesting, but also I don't have the answer to it. But so I do absolutely think that when Parliament moves, probably to Richmond House, I think, which is because Parliament is falling apart as a building, which you see if you're ever there. Like even quite recently, a friend went to like a room. I think it was a bathroom. I can remember like either a bathroom or like some small cupboards, and went in and then tried to go out, and the handle just stayed in his hand, so he was just stuck in that cupboard. There's that, you know, there's waterfalls, so like quite a lot of MPs' offices have buckets in them for the water for whenever it rains. There's mice everywhere, there's the occasional rat, there's pieces of wool that fall on you in the corridor sometimes.
Wool?
Stone just falls. Basically, yeah, the building is really falling apart, so the plans are to probably move everyone to, yeah, so probably a Richmond House, which is literally just down the road for a couple of years to renovate it. Or was it, there is an amazing stat, I think there's a fire, like a small fire, but still, but there's a fire in the Palace of Westminster every 3 days. And it's like, this feels not good. Like, I don't know how many fires a large building should have, but it seems to me like it should be less, like fewer than once every 3 days. But anyway, all of that to say, I think I'd be really interested, especially in seeing if there's a new generation of parliamentarians who arrive while the Palace of Westminster has moved to, let's say, Richmond House. So people who have never known, so kind of, you know, and having a control group, I suppose, of like new MPs who've never known the palace. Because again, so if you look back on when the Palace of Westminster was built, it was very much built with gentlemen's clubs in mind. So the idea was that, you know, it was meant to be quite dark and have these corridors be quite intimidating, because obviously there's a class issue to it as well, because that only certain types of men, you know, became politicians at the time. And it's got the tea rooms, and it's got, you know, so it's kind of, it is Hogwarts, effectively, you know, if you've never been. It is it is hugely intimidating, but also kind of fosters the sort of, you know, conversations in dark corners, and you kind of sit, you know, and you plot in a corner, etc. So it was very much built for that purpose. And again, as you mentioned, so I think there's like six different bars in total, which again is weird because it's a workplace. But I think that moving to a different building, like, I mean, again, I'm not sure how much it will do to people who have already been in Westminster for quite a long time, because again, I suspect that they may change their way slightly for, you know, the 3 or 4 years they get moved to Richmond House. And then, yeah, you know, exactly. But you know, but I suspect that, yeah, again, like they will probably just go back in their kind of set ways once Parliament moves back into Parliament. But then, yeah, no, I think, yeah, I really hope, basically just out to, like, genuinely just for wonkish purposes, that I just really want to know. I'm really curious to see how differently new MPs would behave if they had to move to a building, for example, that, because I think, yeah, Richmond House is a dry building, because it's owned by the Saudis or something, so it's actually that they couldn't have
dry
a bar
as in
there.
No alcohol. Yeah.
That
would be interesting. Nana?
Thank
you. So you said you learned to use because of the tensions between the relationships with different politicians. I wonder if researching for your book, you found that the journalists who are there who will bury stories because of their relationship with politicians.
Huh. So I don't think it's ever, like, or, you know, maybe it is, but I think it's rarely as straightforward as that. So I think there's relatively few cases of, you know, well, you know, this MP did a bad thing, but I like this MP, therefore I'm not going to write it. Like, I don't think that happens very often. I think what can happen, and I remember, so around the time I was writing the book, there was the Andrew Griffiths sex scandal. So if you did not see at the time, it was, I think, the business or small businesses minister who was found to have sexted two young women, I want to say 3,000 times in 2 months. Great story, honestly, like, because they leaked some of the sex as well. They're very, very funny. I really recommend it. I think that was one of my favorite one personally. Each, you know, everyone has their favorite, but it was Daddy's Busy Running the Country, which is such a vile thing to say. But anyway, so I was kind of doing, there is a serious point in there. But yeah, so I was kind of interviewing people at the time that when that scandal was kind of unfolding. So obviously it came up a few times. And one journalist, there was one person, because I interviewed Amber Rudd for the book, and she was quite interesting because she was like, actually, I think that what we've learned from this is that no one really liked Andrew Griffiths, because like no one's really come to his defense. So yeah, like, on the one hand, on the political side, no one's really come to his defense. On the journalistic side, they've clearly gone all in. You know, they're just like, they keep publishing, you know, the most lurid details of it, etc. But then, yeah, one journalist made a point, which I thought was really interesting, and was kind of similar, saying, you know, clearly what we've learned is that Andrew Griffiths has no mates. Because, so that journalist point said, no, I'm going to read him off the record, so I'm just going to have to be quite clumsy and say, and the journalist. But he's sort of saying, actually, because also, you know, beyond, again, and I think I've mentioned it earlier, but beyond the conscious thing of, you know, fuck that guy or whatever, there's also the, he was saying, actually, you know, what if it'd been, you know, one of those MPs that we all liked? So there's a few MPs, normally former journalists as well, because they kind of know how it works, you know, who are, you know, really interesting people, who are really nice, who will, answer to your text, sending a quote quite quickly, who will, you know, go out for lunch with you and have quite, you know, be quite fun at lunch, etc. So, you know, so there are MPs we like as journalists, obviously. And he was saying, he was like, actually, you know, if that happened to one of those MPs, he was like, you know, I'm not sure I could guarantee that, you know, I wouldn't go. Well, actually, you know, I'm fine to go, you know, let's say, yeah, similar sex scandal, I know, cheating on his wife, whatever. If it's someone you like, you're a lot more likely to go, oh, but, you know, like his marriage had me on the rocks for quite a long time. Or, you know, like I know that he's been having a really, really tough time recently. Like he's probably just not in a good place. And that's not even something you do, I think, entirely consciously. It's just, and I think, you know, it doesn't just apply to politics of anyone, you know, I think in any office, if you see a, let's say, yeah, like between your office nemesis or your office best friend getting with someone who's not their partner at the office Christmas party, obviously your moral judgment or your interest in that story will, you know, be vastly different, yeah, depending on how much you like that person. So I think there's a lot more of that. So there's a lot of people's, like journalists' personal feelings about MPs maybe influencing the way they cover them, as opposed to straightforward, I like that person, therefore I'm not publishing that, or I don't like them. So yeah.
I've noting everyone's hand, so Shazia?
Yeah, I was just wondering if, I mean, journalism is facing credibility issues, because journalists are seen as being
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so it's, I mean, they're trying to build up again, but they're
going to be
really tough.
Cool.
So, is there something that could happen there, or how did it happen?
I'm not sure.
Scandal? That's not journalism, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure, because I do think, and again, that sort of comes back to what we were saying earlier, despite the, it's a weird, and again, you know, I'm kind of seeing it, yeah, as a sort of, you know, foreign outsider as well, and I find it super interesting. Because I think that relationship is, yeah, like on the one hand, it is close, I think even unhealthily close at times. But on the other hand, again, there is nothing more British journalist-like than sticking the knife into a politician. and, you know, and I think that, but yeah, even comparing it to, for example, like, you know, French coverage of politics. I remember like there was one brilliant moment, so when it was revealed that François Hollande was having an affair, and there was, and obviously, you know, the British press loved it so much, you know, and I François Hollande on his moped going to his mistress's house, kind of, you know, their Christmas. But, you know, and François Hollande gave a press conference a few days later on something else, you know, something entirely different. I think it may have been like defense policy or something. And anyway, and so, you know, there was the press conference and all the journalists there, you know, and they'd been warned beforehand as well, you know, no questions on the private life of the president. And all the French journalists stuck to that line. And so despite, you know, the scandal everyone was talking about in France, they were in that room and they just asked questions related to, you know, what the press conference had just been about. And then at the very end, you got Christopher Hope from the Daily Telegraph basically going like, Mr. President, did you shag her? And, you know, similar words, but yeah, did you have an affair with that woman or whatever? Which, I mean, A, it was really, really funny. But B, I thought, you know, that was such a fascinating example, actually, of the differences between British political journalism and French political journalism. Well, I think in France, and I think Germany is quite similar as well, and a few other European countries are similar, where there is a degree of deference to politicians.
I think he could do it, but he won't stay forever.
Mm.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Stay in Paris for a couple of years, that's it, gone.
Mm. Oh, no, so Hope is actually based in Britain. He went to France especially to ask that question, which, again, I respect.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, just a day well spent. But, yeah, no, so again, I think, yeah, I think compared to, yeah, other countries, I think Britain, there's still, like, an amount of glee. There's an amount of, like, mischief-making, I suppose, that other countries don't have. And I think, weirdly, it counterbalances the closeness, if that makes sense. So it is, I mean, at heart, I find it quite sociopathic in nature, because yeah. It's both closer and meaner, and I'm like, how does that, but yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Hi. Yeah.
Hi. I found it really interesting you talking about how long these discussions take place on the level of, like, getting a drink with people and sitting down at the cafe, and that kind of, like, very face-to-face, not too professionalized or formalized gossip environment. Because I'm a relatively beginner freelancer, and I'm very much in a very professionalized stage of contact, where you have a few people and you try and figure out how often you need to be honest that they don't forget you exist, but not too much that they get very annoyed at you exist. And I was wondering if you have any kind of insights on how you pass from that very professionalized distance sense of contact to that, like, meeting people in the pub sense. You have to kind of be attached to an institution to cross that barrier, or, like, how do you generally see people get past that barrier?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I don't really know, because I've never. So, what, out of curiosity, what area of journalism are you trying to get
mostly
into?
Mostly literary. I also do a bit of stuff on, like, trans issues, really, but mostly kind of books and literary essays, stuff like that.
Oh, cool. Because I think, you know, I think political journalism is quite specific in how informal it is. So I think that there's still quite a lot of patches within journalism where it is not the done thing to be clear to, like, you know, go for, like, a long boozy lunch, let's say, with a source. Like, that's really not how you do it.
Yeah, I understand how it works in politics journalism specifically, even though that's not my area.
But. It is, but also I think, and again, it comes back to the fact that it's a very, again, it's basically like being a local reporter. So I think the same way that if you're, I don't know, let's say the crime reporter for, like, you know, quite a small town, actually you'll get to know the police officers super well, you'll get to know the firemen super well, because actually you see them every day, you go see them every day. And I remember, you know, when I did work experience in my local paper, when I was still in France, like, it was very much, I followed the crime reporter for a day, and we went for coffee with the police, coffee, whatever, so, you know. And I think, yeah, weirdly, Westminster politics is quite similar, because it's, you know, you see the same people physically constantly. So if anything, it would be probably harder to keep it formal, because if you bump into someone, you're not going to each time go like, hi, and, you know, and how do you do? And how, you know, anyway, you know, lovely day to you. Like, of course, you know, if you bump into them literally every other day for months at a time, you'll end up just developing a relationship that I think is, like, inherently more informal.
But do you need to be attached to a paper to get into the situation where you are running into people every day?
I mean, you can just, you know, stroll the streets of Westminster in your spare time. I do it sometimes. I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily think so. I think I kind of built up, and obviously everyone's got a different way of doing it, but I did kind of build up my career by drinking in the pubs of Westminster. And that was, you know, very much kind of trying to find, like, one friend, and from that one friend I'd go drinking with them, and then I'd sort of, you know, cannibalise their friends, and then from there, they're, you know, and that, and I kind of, like, weaseled my way into Westminster by way of drinking. Yeah, works quite well. So it is doable.
Not great on your liver, thanks to Paula.
I think they probably should have seen it coming, but I mean, so I think the bet that they made is that actually there has been such a thing as the inner lobby for quite a long time, and there's nothing new in, obviously, like, a political party briefing specifically friendly newspapers. Like, you know, that's not new at all. And clearly, you know, Cummings as number 10 has been doing it for quite a long time. So I think their bet was probably actually this is just formalizing something that we all know exists. But I suppose that I think the pack mentality probably kicks in more if they're just physically in front of one another. So it's probably something, you know, it's one of those known things, I would say, of, you know, obviously the Mirror political editor will always have a closer relationship with the Labour Party than with the Conservative Party, and vice versa with, say, the Daily Express. But yes, again, I think it's known, but not necessarily spoken. And so actually, I think if you do make force people into that physical confrontation, they will stick together. Because otherwise, because, you know, the only other option for the many that were giving them was to side with number 10. And effectively, I don't think, you know, no matter how friendly you can be as a paper, you would never side, I think. I think it was actually, yeah.
Mm. Emily. Weirdly, karaoke also a huge thing in British politics. Yeah. But we can, yeah, so side note.
Yeah, I'm just going to repeat the question to the mic here, which is journalists hanging out with politicians, which isn't just drinking, it's mahjong and karaoke and barbecues at weekends. And is there a line which you think that's too much now?
Ooh. I think, and then that's something I tried to investigate in the book, and I asked people, and very helpfully, everyone had a different answer. But I think everyone has a different line. So the one I ended up putting in the book, I think if I remember correctly, was from Michael White, who's the former political editor of The Guardian. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what, I'll socialize with politicians, but never in my house and never in theirs. So the idea was, you know, it always has to be in a third, you know, space, which I think is quite good. But then, I don't know, so what I personally find really interesting about that is that it is, so A, I think there's two things. A, it's really, you see, it's one thing to have a line in your head of saying, okay, well, let's say if I meet an MP now, you know, yeah, I'd never go to their house, they'd never come to mine. We would not hang out during the summer holidays or something, you know, then you can make your rules. But I think what makes it a lot harder is that you don't, and I was thinking about it recently, is that these relationships can sort of develop without you necessarily noticing it. Because I was thinking about it because it's about, two, three weeks ago, I was at the birthday of my friend's birthday, which is a house party on a Saturday night in his house. And he's a government special advisor. And then, you know, so kind of had a few drinks, blah, blah, and left about midnight. And when I was going down the stairs, I ended up doing small talk with this woman who I vaguely know, who's an MP now, and being like, ah, ha, ha, you know, I think like really dull end of house party stuff, like, look at us, we're leaving at like 9:15, we're so, you know, responsible, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, and you know, on the bus back, I thought, actually, this feels interesting, because from the outside, you know, I never would have gone to just like the birthday party of a government special advisor and then done small talk with an MP there. You know, that's something that for me would cross my lines. But actually what happened is that mate, you know, I've known for years and was not a special advisor, was nowhere near being a spad when I first met him, and then we kind of became friends, and then he became a spad. And then that MP I knew similarly, I don't know them that well, but, you know, but I'd met before they were an MP, before everything. And so I think it's basically just all to say, you know, I met both of those people,
back when it was not problematic at all for me to establish a relationship, like a friendship with them, but then they kind of rose up the ranks. And so I think that happens quite a lot of, like, actually, you know, like people grow with their friendships, and then the friendships become problematic. By then you're like, oh, but what do I do now? Because you're not going to become less friends with someone once they become elected, or, you know, once they become a minister or something. So it's something that's quite hard to negotiate. Yeah, I know, absolutely. So I haven't really, I think, just in the sense that, like, I'm just super social and I like making friends. So, you know, I'm just always just like, yay, more pals.
And I wonder if that's part of it. You need to be inherently really sociable and willing to spend a lot of time.
I'm always quite curious. I remember talking to an acquaintance as a political journalist a few weeks ago who never drinks in Westminster and doesn't, you know, isn't really interested in making friends there or, you know, doing the social aspect of Westminster. And I remember being like, why are you here then? Because, like, you know, because the job is actually, you know, you still get all the bad sides of the job, but you get none of the good sides, you know. And then to me, I've always seen it as actually, you know, quite a lot of political journalists and people who work in politics are those social types, because it's, you know, kind of what you get as an add-on to the job. But also, I think, just to finish on that thing, and maybe that's naive of me, but it's also, I think what happens a lot is just that, you know, if you want to work, you know, be a politician, a special advisor, a political journalist, you do really have to care about politics and follow everything that happens and find it genuinely interesting and want to talk about it and then be very nerdy. Otherwise, you know, why would you do that job? And very, very few people in Britain or other countries care about politics that much. And I think it is partly just, you know, I think, you know, I'm probably closer in terms of what I want to talk about on the night out to a government special advisor than I am to, like, maybe, you know, but even, like, you know, a journalist who works in a different patch. So I think at heart as well, the problem is that we all need to be quite obsessive about what we do in order to do those jobs. So naturally, we'll always end up getting along.
That's a really good point. Thank you.
And the same with socializing. Like, are you ever kind of just wanting to go for a drink with some friends, but then some political gossip comes up and you're like, don't necessarily want to deal with it right then, or are you just like, got to be ready to work whenever?
Oh, and can I add an adjunct to the online question, which I was going to ask? There's a lot about kind of the online abuse of female politicians, female journalists. Do you get that? Do you feel that?
I don't know which order. I can start with that. Yeah. It's sort of weird, actually. I think, so I do get online abuse, but it's not, I feel like people sort of like picture, I suppose, is like, you know, quite a steady level of abuse, like, you know, sort of day in, day out, when it's not really that. So it's normally like, at least in my experience, kind of like nothing for a while, then an absolute avalanche of abuse, then it comes down again, then it comes back up. But interestingly as well, I never know what will trigger it. And it's because it's been happening for so long that now occasionally I'm like, oh, that tweet, didn't have that one down as the one that would get me shouted at. But, you know, I'm used to it. Like, my mentions on Twitter are on complete lockdown anyway, so I only, in my mentions tab, I only see tweets from people I follow, which is annoying, which I really didn't want to do, actually, because I really enjoy, like, part of the reason why I like Twitter is because I like people replying to me and I like engaging with them. But it just became, you know, bad for my mental health to just, like, occasionally wake up and look at tweets and being like, you know, kill yourself. And it's like, oh, good morning to you. But yeah, no, so I think there's that. But no, in terms of shutting down, I don't know, I was basically born and bred online. So, you know, there's not, I find it immensely more stressful to be offline than to be online, I think. You know, I very much relax by just going to, like, different bits of the internet. But then in terms of getting the balance, I think there's quite a natural I was sort of like reflecting back on it actually recently, because there was the Kebab Award yesterday, which is a big event in the Westminster calendar, and I just could not be bothered going. And I didn't go, and instead I was messaging my friend who thought an MP was hot, and I was trying to egg her on to try and go chat her up. And I was like, oh my God, like, I'm an elder in Westminster now. Like, you know, I'm just in bed, what was it, looking online because I'm moving to a new flat, trying to find a nice dish rack while texting my friend being like, go on, go on. but no, but so more seriously, I do think that there's probably a wave of, like, at least for me, you know, for me and I think for the people I've talked about it with, and you kind of come into Westminster, and obviously you're like, oh, you know, and it is quite overwhelming at first, you know, partly the amount of information that becomes accessible to you, but also, and that's the point that's quite at the end of the book from a former Tory staffer, which I thought was really interesting, which is that the second you arrive in Westminster, no matter how junior you are, politicians go from being, you know, these figures you see in the papers, whatever, to at most maybe being 3 degrees removed from you. And I think the example that person uses, like Michael Gove, is that actually Michael Gove's gone from, you know, the Secretary of State I've seen in the papers and on telly to my friend's friend's boss. And so suddenly everyone is kind of connected to you, and the gossip becomes obviously more fun when it's people you feel you have that connection with. And so I think, yeah, from there, it's quite easy, I think, to get entirely swallowed up by the bubble. And yeah, because, you know, why go out with your normal boring friends when you can go out in Westminster? And so on top of having a fun night out, you may like meet some MPs, you may get a story out of it, you may, so it's a kind of a night out. And I do think you probably, because yeah, again, because I know a few people who've had, I think, a similar journey, so you do kind of, yeah, get swallowed up by that bubble, and like suddenly you go out in Westminster all the time and blah blah blah. And then I don't know, I think it's quite organic, and I think it happens at different points for everyone, but there's a point where you're like, actually, you know, do I really want to go out, let's say, in Parliament tonight? And, you know, and woo, I may get to meet a junior minister and do polite and slightly awkward small talk with them for 7 minutes. And it's like, weirdly, that's not as attractive as seeing my uni mates. Like, you know, and so I do think that, you know, you do find a balance after a while. But again, you know, but I think everyone's different.
Have you ever had to, like, try and, like, sober up in order to, like, get some
oh no, I'm just really good at working drunk.
Really?
So I think there's two things. The first one is that of when I used to work at Evening Standard, we had to file copy in the evening, and I won generally one of my main professional achievements, like, it literally is bigger the book than that, which is that in 2015 at Labour conference I filed a piece at 4 a.m., sat in bed with only one eye open, because otherwise the screen kept moving. And then the piece made it into the Evening Standard the next day with basically no edits. The copy was perfect. But anyway, so I think there's that, but I think, and again, you know, that's something that probably arrives with time and experience, but you can also just drink less. Like, I drink considerably less now than I did a few years ago, but that means you can still go out. It's just that you'll maybe have a glass of wine in your hand that you will nurse for 2 hours, which means that you can just be out without being drunk.
Excellent.
Yeah. I wondered whether you think that sort of politicians' personal lives are fair game, because you kind of suggested that in France and Germany, it's that journalists still have deference to politicians that they don't in the UK. And well, I think that's definitely true. I mean, unless somebody's involved in criminal activities, say with an underage girl or something, why should we be writing about extramarital affairs? Who are we to judge, you know, whether Holland goes off on his motorcycle or not? I personally couldn't care less, and I couldn't care less if Clinton and Monica were in the Oval Office and what they did together, because it was as two.
That one is a abuse of power, though.
That one was abuse of power, I suppose, yeah.
But the other ones.
Between two consenting adults, okay, who? Lewinsky's a bad example because she worked for the guy. Mm. But just some MP in Westminster is having an affair with the
The vast majority of affairs do not get written about.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's a, like, I probably take, I don't know, quite a nuanced view on that, in that I think some of the stories are fair game. So, for example, you know, and it's one of the classic ones, but if it, I mean, the two types of it are either the family values politicians, so normally someone who appears on all their leaflets, with their wife and 2.4 children, you know, in front of the white picket fence, and they're just like, you know, yeah. So people like that, you know, it tends to be men as well who will open every statement with, you know, and as a family man myself, obviously, if that person is cheating, I do think actually the argument is fair in saying, well, you know, they probably got elected by at least some people, you know, voted for some people because they've got that image, they've used that image for electoral purposes, therefore that's hypocrisy if they're cheating on the side. Or obviously the other one of people cheating who... And that one is pettier, but I'm still fully in favour of it. But yeah, people who cheat on their spouse, but who voted against gay marriage. And it's like, well, so, you know, don't want the gays to get married. But clearly, you know, you feel very strongly about the institution of marriage. So I think that, you know, there can occasionally be, a public interest angle. Then some of them, you know, obviously newspapers are, I think in Britain, very, very good at, sort of like bending the idea of public interest to their will and to their interests. One of my favourite ones, I think David Mellor, the minister, like when he was cheating, like some time ago, and the excuse the Mirror used to publish a story, that was effectively just, you know, David Mellor is like shagging someone, was, well, like 3 months ago, the minister complained that he was really tired at the moment. Well, we found out why he was tired, because he was sleeping. And it's like, come on. There's that. There's one of my favourites, which is used quite often, is still the blackmail risk of, like, and it's normally if someone has done something which is not in the public interest, it's probably like a bit of a like fruity sex act. That's normally the one, and they go, you know, and that gets published under the guise of, well, you know, what if Russia finds out and blackmails them? And it's like, that would never happen. You just wanted to publish the funny sex act. So I do think that basically, I mean, I could make the argument for some, you know, some stories published about politicians' private lives, but others I think are just fundamentally, and also I think fundamentally because, I don't know, I think Britain has quite a moralistic press, like more so at least, you know, than France and stuff. So there's that weird mix of obviously we want to publish, you know, every single last detail of, let's say, yeah, an MP's affair with someone, but at the same time we want to do that to judge them because that's very bad and he should not do that as a man in public life. And so I think that there's that weird they're very like moralistic, I suppose other countries' papers aren't necessarily.
Were until sort of Trump, and then everybody forgot and went, oh, he grabbed pussy, that's fine. You know, whereas before that would have killed.
Oh, but then, can I? Yep. But then I think that's because if you look at the information ecosystem and the role gossip plays in society, shame plays a massive role as well. So normally, because gossip is used, and that's all in the book as well, but I think gossip is also used to regulate behavior. Informally, so in that, you know, if you do something, you know, it may something that's not illegal but something that's clearly frowned upon by your social group, you know, you're encouraged not to do it because if you do it, it may get gossiped about, it may get talked about, everyone will find out and your social status may suffer from it. But the problem is, you know, and if you put it through the media, it's normally, you know, let's say MP does an embarrassing thing, it gets gossiped about, newspaper finds out, newspaper publishes gossipy story, MP feels terrible about it, apologises, you know, maybe even steps down from like a position they were in or whatever, and then, you know, newspaper has won, gossip had a use. Whereas if you do all those stages, but up until, you know, newspaper publishes the story and politician goes,
yeah,
cool, then what? Then actually, you know, that negates, I think, the entire process. So I do think that, yeah, gossip, like shame is a, because gossip is quite tied to, yeah, social norms. And social norms are inherently quite tied to the concept of shame in order to get.
And when you've got politicians with no shame, yeah, the gossip loses its currency. Mm. I'm going to wind up because I've made Marie talk kind of for a good hour and 20 minutes, and obviously we can keep going, but I just want to say thank you. I'm sorry about all the questions come up and ask, but thank you so much for agreeing. Thank you.